author of The New Pearl Harbor, and it's my pleasure to bring him to the stage and bring him to you right now. Dr. Griffin.
Thank you very much. In my first book on 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor, I summarized dozens of facts and reports that contradicted the official story about 9/11. Then in my second book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, I showed how the 9/11 Commission dealt with all those facts and reports, that is, by distorting a few of them and simply omitting the rest of them. So I've been giving a cumulative argument, a big picture approach, and there's a real advantage to this big picture approach because it shows that no matter where you begin with the official story, it's problematic. And that's very important to realize. But one problem with this big picture approach is it means that the treatment of each issue must be quite brief and therefore superficial. And that leaves the way open for skeptics to suspect that maybe if we looked a little more deeply into one of these issues, we'd see the official story made sense after all. And so today, I'm going to focus on one question and one question only. Why did the Twin Towers and Building 7 of the World Trade Center collapse? One advantage of this focus, besides the fact that it will allow us to go into this issue in some detail, is that the destruction of the World Trade Center, I have become convinced, provides one of the best, perhaps the best window into the truth about 9/11. Another advantage of this focus is that it will allow us to look at the revelations that are contained in the 9/11 oral histories, which were recorded by the New York Fire Department shortly after 9/11, but were released to the public only this past August. So I will begin with the question of the Twin Towers and then later talk about Building 7. Shortly after 9/11, President Bush advised people not to tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories about the attacks of 9/11. Philip Zelikow, who directed the 9/11 Commission, has likewise warned against outrageous conspiracy theories. What do these men mean by this phrase? They cannot mean that we should reject all conspiracy theories about 9/11 because the official theory is itself a conspiracy theory. They only mean that we should reject outrageous theories. But what is the difference between an outrageous theory and a non-outrageous theory? This is one of the central questions in the philosophy of science. When confronted by rival theories, let's say neo-Darwinian evolution and intelligent design, scientists and philosophers of science ask which theory is better and why. The mark of a good theory is it can explain in a coherent way all or at least most of the relevant facts and is contradicted by none of them. A bad theory is one that is contradicted by some of the relevant facts. An outrageous theory would be one that is contradicted by virtually all of the relevant facts. With this definition in mind, let us look at the official theory about the Twin Towers, which says that they collapsed because of the combined effect of the impact of the airplanes plus the resulting fires. The later report put out by FEMA said the structural damage sustained by each tower from the impact, combined with the ensuing fires, resulted in the total collapse of each building. This theory clearly belongs to the category of outrageous theories because it is contradicted by all the relevant facts. Now, that may seem like an extreme statement to some of you, but I will try to show why it is not. The official theory is rendered implausible by two major problems. The first is the simple fact that fire has never, prior to nor after 9/11, caused steel-framed high-rise buildings to collapse. Defenders of the official theory seldom, if ever, mention this simple fact. Indeed, the supposedly definitive report put out recently by NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, even implies that fire-induced collapses of large steel frame buildings are normal events. But far from being normal, such collapses had never occurred. Defenders of the official theory, of course, say that the collapses were caused not simply by the fires, but from the fires combined with the impact from the airplanes. The towers, however, were designed to withstand the impact of airliners about the same size as a Boeing 767. Hyman Brown, the construction manager of the Twin Towers, said they were over-designed to withstand almost anything, including hurricanes, bombings, and an airplane hitting them. And even Thomas Eagar, an MIT professor of materials and engineering science who supports the official theory, says that the impact of the airplanes would not have been significant because the number of columns lost on the initial impact was not large and the loads were shifted to remaining columns in this highly redundant structure. Likewise, the NIST report, in discussing how the impact of the airliners played a role, focuses primarily on the claim that the planes dislodged a lot of the fireproofing material from the steel. So the official theory of the collapse is essentially a fire theory. So it cannot be overemphasized that fire has never caused large steel frame buildings to collapse. Never, whether before 9/11 or after 9/11 or on 9/11 anywhere else in the world except allegedly New York City. Never. One might say, of course, there is a first time for everything, and that a really significant fire, an extraordinary fire, might induce a collapse. Well, let's look at this possibility. What would count as an extraordinary fire? Given the characteristics of steel, the fire would need to be very hot, very big, and very long-lasting. But the fires in the towers did not have one, let alone all three, of these characteristics. There have been claims, to be sure, that the fires were very hot. Some television specials claimed that the towers collapsed because the fire was hot enough to melt steel. For example, an early BBC special said, quoting a man presented as a structural engineer, "It was the fire that killed the buildings. There's nothing on earth that could survive those temperatures with that amount of fuel burning. The columns would have melted." But that claim is absurd. Steel does not begin to melt until it reaches almost 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And yet open fires fueled by hydrocarbons such as kerosene, which is what essentially jet fuel is, can at most rise to 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're about 1,100 degrees short of the melting point of steel. So we can dismiss the idea that the buildings collapsed because their steel melted. Most defenders of the official theory, to be sure, do not make this absurd claim. They say merely that the fire heated the steel up to the point where it lost so much of its strength that it buckled. For example, Thomas Eagar, saying that the steel loses 80% of its strength when it is heated to 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit, argues that this is what happened. But for even this claim to be plausible, the fires would have still had to be very hot. But they were not. People have made claims about the thousands of gallons of jet fuel that were poured into these buildings. But much of the fuel was burned up in the first few seconds in those tremendous fireballs, and the rest of it would have been burned up within 10 minutes. After which, the flames died down. Photographs of the towers 15 minutes after they were struck show few flames and lots of black smoke, a sign that the fires were oxygen-starved and therefore could not be very hot. Thomas Eagar, recognizing this fact, said that the fires were probably only about 1,200 or 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit. Moreover, there are reasons to believe they were not even nearly that hot. As photographs show, the fires did not break the windows or even spread much beyond their points of origins, suggesting that they were not hot enough to ignite paper, plastic, or wood. This photographic evidence is supported by scientific studies carried out by NIST itself, which indicated that they found no steel that had been exposed to temperatures more than 500 degrees Fahrenheit. Moreover, even if the fires had reached the temperature of 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit, as Eagar supposes, that does not mean any of the steel would have gotten that hot. Steel is an excellent conductor of heat. Put a fire to a bar of steel, and the heat will diffuse throughout the steel and to any other pieces of steel to which it is connected. For fires to have heated any of the steel columns to anywhere close to the temperature of the fires, they would have needed to be very big relative to the size of the building and the amount of steel in it. And of course, the Twin Towers were huge buildings with an enormous amount of steel. A small localized fire of 1,300 degrees would never have heated any of the steel columns, even close to that temperature, because the heat would have quickly dispersed throughout the rest of the building. Defenders of the official theory have said that the fires were indeed very big, turning the buildings into towering infernos. But all the evidence counts against this claim, especially with regard to the South Tower, which collapsed first. The South Tower was struck between floors 78 and 84. So that is where the fire would have been the biggest. And yet Brian Clark, a survivor, said that when he got down to the 80th floor, you could see through the wall and the cracks and see flames just licking up, not a roaring inferno, just quiet flames licking up and the smoke sort of eking through the wall. Likewise, one of the fire chiefs, who had reached the 78th floor, found only two isolated pockets of fire. The North Tower, to be sure, did have fires that were big enough and hot enough to cause people to jump to their deaths. But as anyone with a fireplace grate or even a potbelly stove knows, fire that will not harm steel or even iron will burn human flesh. In any case, the fires to weaken the steel columns would have needed not only to be very big and very hot, but also very long-lasting. The public was told that the fires had this characteristic, with CNN saying that very intense fires burn for a long time. But they did not. The North Tower collapsed an hour and 42 minutes after it was struck. The South Tower collapsed after only 56 minutes. To see how ludicrous is the claim that the short-lived fires in the towers could have induced structural collapse, we can compare them with some other fires. In 1988, a fire in the First Interstate Bank building in Los Angeles raged for 3.5 hours and gutted 5 of this building's 62 floors, but there was no significant structural damage. In 1991, a huge fire in Philadelphia's One Meridian Plaza lasted for 18 hours and gutted 8 of the building's 38 floors. But, said the FEMA report, although beams and girders sagged and twisted under severe fire exposure, the columns continued to support their loads without obvious damage. In Caracas in 2004, a fire in a 50-story building raged for 17 hours, completely gutting the building's top 20 floors, and yet it did not collapse. Unlike the fires in the towers, moreover, all of these fires were hot enough to break windows. Perhaps the most decisive comparison is provided by a series of experiments run in Great Britain in the mid-1990s to see what kind of damage could be induced in buildings by subjecting them to extremely hot, all-consuming, long-lasting fires. FEMA, having reviewed these experiments, said, despite the temperature of the steel beams reaching 1500 to 1700 degrees Fahrenheit in three of the tests, no collapse was observed in any of the experiments. These facts bring out the absurdity of NIST's claim that the towers collapsed because the planes knocked the fireproofing off the steel columns. Fireproofing provides protection for only a few hours. So the steel in the buildings in Philadelphia and Caracas would have been directly exposed to raging fires for 14 or 15 hours without any fireproofing left. And yet this steel did not buckle. It is absurd to say the steel in the South Tower buckled because it was directly exposed to flames for 56 minutes. There is reverse truth to the fact that, aside from the alleged cases of 9/11, fire has never caused large steel frame buildings to collapse. This reverse truth is that every previous collapse has been caused by the procedure known as controlled demolition, in which explosives capable of cutting steel have been placed in crucial places throughout the building and then set off in a particular order. Therefore, just from knowing that the towers collapsed, the a priori assumption would be that they were brought down by controlled demolition. And this a priori assumption is supported also by the particular nature of the collapses. Here we come to the second major problem in the official theory, namely that the collapses had at least 10 characteristics that come with controlled demolition. I will now briefly indicate those 10 characteristics. First, in controlled demolition, the onset of the collapse is sudden. One moment the building is perfectly motionless, the next moment it suddenly begins to collapse. But steel, when heated, does not suddenly buckle or break. So in fire-induced collapses, if we had ever had any examples of such, the onset would be gradual. Horizontal beams and trusses would begin to sag. Vertical columns, if subjected to strong forces, would begin to bend. But as videos of the towers show, there were no signs of bending or sagging, even on the floors just above the damage caused by the impact of the airplanes. The buildings were perfectly motionless up till the moment they began to collapse. Second, the most important thing, by the way, about halfway through we're going to run some videos that'll show you the towers and also Building 7, which I'll talk about later. So you might want to make a note of these 10 characteristics and then see how many of them you can observe in the video. So the first was sudden onset. Second, the most important thing in a controlled demolition of a tall building that is near other buildings is that it comes straight down into or at least close to the building's own footprint so that it does not destroy the surrounding buildings. The whole art or science of controlled demolition is oriented primarily around this goal. As Marc Loiseau, the president of Controlled Demolition Incorporated, has explained, to bring a building down as we want, so no other structure is harmed, the demolition must be completely planned, using the right explosives and the right pattern of laying the charges. If the 110-story Twin Towers had fallen over, they would have caused an enormous amount of damage in Lower Manhattan. But the towers came straight down. The official theory, therefore, requires a miracle, with fire-producing collapses that perfectly mimicked the kind of collapses that have otherwise been produced only by precisely placed explosives. Third, Buildings brought down by controlled demolition collapse at almost free fall speed. This can occur because the supports for the lower floors are destroyed, so that when the upper floors come down, they encounter no resistance. The fact that the collapses of the towers mimic this feature of controlled demolition was indirectly mentioned by the 9/11 Commission, which said that the South Tower collapsed in 10 seconds. Now, actually, that's some exaggeration. It was closer to 14 seconds. But in any case, the authors of the report thought evidently that this very rapid collapse did not conflict with the official theory, which is a pancake theory, according to which the floors above the hole created by the impact of the airplane collapsed on the floor below it, bringing their weight and down, and then they pancaked all the way down. But if that's what happened, the lower floors, with all their steel and concrete, would have provided some resistance. The upper floors could not have fallen through them at the same speed as they would fall through the air. And yet the videos of the collapses show that the rubble falling inside the building's profile falls at the same speed as the rubble falling outside the building's profile. Fourth, the official theory is even more decisively ruled out by the fact that the collapses were total. These 110-story buildings collapsed into piles of rubble no more than a few stories high. According to the pancake theory, the horizontal steel supports broke free from the vertical columns, and that allowed the floors to pancake down. But if that is what happened, it would have been like the old 78 phonographs in which the records fell, but the spindle still sticking up in the air. The 9/11 Commission came up with a bold solution to this problem. The problem, of course, is that the core of each building had not just a spindle, but 47 of them, 47 massive steel columns. The bold solution of the 9/11 Commission was simply to deny the existence of those columns. It said, the interior core of the building was a hollow steel shaft in which elevators and stairwells were grouped. Voila! No core columns. Most serious problem with total collapse solved. NIST's report handled this most difficult problem by claiming that when the floors collapsed, they pulled on the core columns and the perimeter columns, causing the perimeter columns to become unstable. This instability then increased the gravity load on the core columns, which had been weakened by tremendously hot fires in the core, which NIST claims reached 1,832 degrees Fahrenheit, and this combination of factors somehow produced global collapse, their word for total collapse. Well, of course, one problem with this is that there's no evidence whatsoever for those tremendously hot fires of 1,832 degrees. As I said earlier, NIST found evidence only of temperatures of 500 degrees, so they added more than 1,300 degrees with pure speculation. But even worse than that, even if they could have made a case for that, that would have provided no explanation whatsoever for this theory of total collapse. The NIST report asserts that column failure occurred in the core as well as the perimeter columns. But this remains a bare assertion. There is no plausible explanation with anything close to scientific rigor about how such column failure could have occurred. Five, in controlled demolitions of steel frame buildings, explosives are used to slice the steel columns and beams into pieces. A representative from Controlled Demolition, Inc., has said of RDX, one of the commonly used high explosives, that it slices steel like a razor blade through a tomato. The steel, moreover, is not merely sliced. It is sliced into manageable lengths. As Controlled Demolition, Inc. says in its publicity, our systems segment steel components into pieces matching the lifting capacity of the available equipment. The collapses of the Twin Towers magically mimicked this feature of controlled demolitions also. Jim Hoffman, after studying various photos of the collapsed site, said that much of the steel seemed to be chopped up into sections that could be easily loaded onto the equipment that was cleaning up Ground Zero. 6. Another feature of controlled demolition is the production of a lot of dust. Because explosives powerful enough to slice steel will pulverize concrete and any other non-metallic substances into very fine dust. And Hoffman reports, nearly all of the non-metallic constituents of the towers were pulverized into fine powder. That observation was also made by Colonel John O'Dowd of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. At the World Trade Center sites, he told the History Channel, it seemed like everything was pulverized. This fact creates a problem for the official theory, according to which the only energy available was the gravitational energy. This energy seems wholly unsuited to explain the pulverization, especially in the first few seconds. In Hoffman's words, you can see thick clouds of pulverized concrete being ejected within the first 2 seconds. That's when the relative motion of the top of the tower to the intact portion was only a few feet per second. And yet we're to believe that those very slowly moving pieces of concrete somehow pulverized themselves by hitting each other into very fine dust particles. 7. Another common feature of controlled demolitions are dust clouds, which result when explosions eject the dust from the building with tremendous energy. And as one can see by comparing the videos of the Twin Towers collapses with controlled demolitions on the web, such as the Seattle Kingdom, it's very similar. The only difference is that the dust clouds from the Twin Towers are much bigger, suggesting that even a much greater explosive energy was employed. The question of the source of the needed energy again arises. Hoffman, focusing on the expansion of the North Tower's dust cloud, calculates that the energy required simply for this expansion, leaving aside the energy needed to pulverize the concrete and slice the steel, would be about at least 10 times as great as the energy available from gravity. So the official account involves a huge violation of the laws of physics, a violation that becomes even more profound when we bring in the amount of energy needed to slice the steel and pulverize the concrete and the other materials. 8. Another common feature of controlled demolition is the horizontal ejection of other materials besides the dust from those areas of the building in which the explosives are set off. In the case of the Twin Towers, photos and videos reveal that heavy pieces of steel were ejected in all directions for distances up to 500 feet, while aluminum cladding was blown up to 700 feet away from the towers. But gravitational energy is vertical. It cannot begin to explain these tremendous horizontal ejections. 9. Still another common feature of collapses induced by explosions are demolition rings, in which a series of small explosions run rapidly around the building. This feature was also manifested by the Twin Towers. A 10th feature of collapses induced by explosives is, logically enough, the occurrence of sights and sounds produced by the explosions. Besides hearing the explosions, witnesses may see flashes and/or demolition rings. Some testimony suggestive of explosions in the tower, provided by reporters, firefighters, medical workers, police workers, and people who worked in the buildings, has long been available. A few of these testimonies, such as those of janitor William Rodriguez, engineer Mike Pecoraro, firefighter Louis Caccioli, and employee Teresa Veliz, are very impressive. But we didn't have many such testimonies. But this situation has now dramatically changed. Shortly after 9/11, the New York Fire Department recorded over 500 oral histories in which firefighters and emergency medical workers recounted their experiences of that day. Mayor Bloomberg's administration refused to release these oral histories, but the New York Times, joined by several families of the 9/11 victims, filed suit, and after a very long process, the city was ordered by the New York Court of Appeals to release these oral histories, which they did this past August. The Times then made these oral histories available, so you can go on the web and read them for yourself. These oral histories contain many dozens of testimonies that speak of explosions and related phenomena characteristic of controlled demolition. I will now give some examples. Several people reported a single explosion followed by collapse of one tower or the other. Many people reported multiple explosions. Paramedic Kevin Darnowski said, "I heard three explosions, and then Tower 2 started to come down." Firefighter Thomas Turilli said, "It almost sounded like bombs going off, like boom, 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 like seven or eight." Craig Carlson said that he and other firefighters heard explosions coming from the South Tower. There were about 10 explosions. We then realized the building started to come down. Firefighter Joseph Meola said, "It looked like the building was blowing out on all four sides. We actually heard the pops." Paramedic Daniel Rivera also mentioned pops. Asked how he knew the South Tower was coming down, he said, "It was a frigging noise. At first I thought it was, do you ever see professional demolition where they set the charges on certain floors and then you hear pop, 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 pop? That's what I thought it was." According to the official account, the pancaking began when the floors above the hole caused by the airplane fell on the floors below, as I said before. But some witnesses reported that the collapse of the South Tower began somewhat lower. Timothy Burke, speaking of the South Tower, said that the building popped lower than the fire. Firefighter Edward Cachia said, "It actually gave at a lower floor, not the floor where the plane hit. We originally had thought that there was like an internal explosion because it went in succession. Boom, 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 boom. And then the tower came down." Some of the witnesses spoke of flashes and a phenomena suggestive of demolition rings. Assistant Commissioner Stephen Gregory said, "I thought before number two came down that I saw low-level flashes. I saw a flash, flash, flash at the lower level of the building. You know, like when they demolish a building?" Captain Karen DeShore said, "Somewhere around the middle, there was this orange and red flash coming out. Initially, it was just one flash. Then this flash just kept popping all the way around the building, and that building had started to explode." Firefighter Richard Benesiski, speaking of the South Tower, said, "There was just an explosion. It seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings. It seemed like it was going all the way around like a belt, all these explosions." Deputy Commissioner Thomas Fitzpatrick said, "It looked like sparkling around one specific layer of the building. My initial reaction was that this was exactly the way it looks when they show you these implosions on TV." A few witnesses spoke of horizontal ejections. Chief Frank Crothers said, "There was what appeared to be an explosion. It appeared at the very top, simultaneously from all four sides. Material shot out horizontally, and then there seemed to be a momentary delay before you could see the beginning of the collapse." This testimony is very important because the official theory says that the horizontal ejections were produced when the floors collapsed and pushed the materials out. So listen to firefighter James Curran, who said, "I looked back and I heard like every floor went choo, choo, choo. I looked back and from the pressure, everything was getting blown out of the floors before it actually collapsed." If all these firefighters and medical workers witnessed all these phenomena suggestive of controlled demolition, it might be wondered why they have not spoken out. Part of the answer is probably provided by Auxiliary Lieutenant Fireman Paul Isaac. Having said that there were definitely bombs in those buildings, Isaac added that many other firemen know there were bombs in the buildings, but they're afraid for their jobs to admit it because the higher-ups forbid discussion of this fact. Another part of the answer is that when a few people have spoken out, the mainstream press has failed to report their statements. Isaac, for example, has more recently said, "I know 9/11 was an inside job. The police know it's an inside job. And the firemen know it too. But you have not heard this on the nightly news or read it in mainstream newspapers." These facts, taken together, render the likelihood of the official theory essentially zero. There is virtually no chance that any one of these 10 phenomena could be produced in the absence of explosives. But let's be generous and say maybe there's a 1% chance that the sudden onset could be produced without explosives. Let's say there's a 1% chance that you could have collapse at virtually free fall speed without explosives. And say this for all 10 characteristics. But when you figure up then probabilities in terms of probability theory, we would be talking about a probability of less than 1 in a trillion. So we can say that the official theory about the towers is disproved as thoroughly as such a theory could possibly be, whereas all the evidence can be explained by the alternative theory according to which the towers were brought down by explosives. The official theory is accordingly an outrageous theory, whereas the alternative theory is, from a scientific point of view, the only reasonable theory available. Although we've already looked at enough Although we've already looked at enough evidence for the theory that the towers were brought down by explosives, there's still more. For one thing, the steel from the buildings was quickly removed before it could be properly examined, and with virtually all of it being sold to dealers and much of it put on boats to be shipped to Asia to be melted down. Generally, removing any evidence from a fire scene is a federal collapse. You cannot pick up a matchbook. And yet, in this case, federal officials facilitated the very rapid removal of the steel. This removal evoked protest. On Christmas Day, 2001, the New York Times said, "The decision to rapidly recycle the steel columns, beams, and trusses from the World Trade Center in the days immediately after 9/11 means definitive answers may never be known." The next week, Fire Engineering Magazine said, "We are literally treating the steel removed from the site like garbage, not like crucial fire scene evidence. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately." However, Mayor Bloomberg, defending the decision to dispose of the steel, said, "If you want to take a look at the construction methods and design, that's in this day and age what computers do. Just looking at a piece of steel generally doesn't tell you anything." But that is not true. Looking at steel would have revealed whether or not it was sliced by explosives. The suggestion that explosives might have been placed in the towers raises the question of how anyone wanting to place explosives in the building could have gotten past the security checks. This question brings us to a possibly relevant fact about a company then called Securicom, that was in charge of security for the World Trade Center. From 1993 to 2000, during which Securicom installed a new security system, Marvin Bush, the president's brother, was one of the directors of the company. And from 1999 until January of 2002, their cousin, Wirt Walker III, was the CEO. One would think these facts might have made the evening news, or at least the 9/11 Commission report. These facts, in any case, may be relevant to some reports given by people who had worked in the World Trade Center. Some of them reportedly said that although in the weeks before 9/11 there had been a security alert that mandated the use of bomb-sniffing dogs, that alert was lifted 5 days before 9/11. Also, a man named Scott Forbes, who worked for Fiduciary Trust, the company for which Kristen Breitweiser's husband worked, has written, "On the weekend of September 8th and 9th, 2001, there was a power down condition in the South Tower. This power down condition meant that there was no electrical supply for approximately 36 hours from floors 50 up. The reason given by the World Trade Center for the power down was that cabling in the tower was being upgraded. Of course, without power, there were no security cameras, no security locks on doors, while many engineers were coming in and out of the towers." Also, a man named Ben Fountain, who was a financial analyst with Fireman's Fund in the South Tower, was quoted in People magazine as saying, "During the weeks before 9/11, the towers were evacuated a number of times, and that was highly unusual." One more possibly relevant fact is that then Mayor Rudy Giuliani, talking on ABC News about his temporary emergency command center at 75 Barclay Street, said, "We were operating out of there when we were told that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. And it did collapse before we could get out of the building." This is an amazing statement. Prior to 9/11, fire had never brought down a steel frame high-rise building. The fireman who reached the 78th floor of the South Tower certainly did not believe it was going to collapse. Even the 9/11 Commission had said that, to its knowledge, none of the fire chiefs present believed that a total collapse of either tower was possible. So why in the world would anyone have told the mayor that at least one of the towers was about to collapse? The most reasonable answer, especially in the light of our more recent information, is that someone knew that explosives had been set in the South Tower and were about to be discharged. It is even possible that the explosives were going to be discharged earlier than originally planned, because the fires in the South Tower were dying down more quickly than may have been expected. This is because, of course, the plane that hit the South Tower hit it at the corner, and so much of the fuel went outside, and that's why with the South Tower you had this even much more impressive fireball. But that meant that there was even less jet fuel to get the fire started in building the South Tower. This could explain why, although the South Tower was struck second, suffered less structural damage, and had smaller fires, it collapsed first, after only 56 minutes. In other words, if the official theory is going to be the building collapsed because of fire, the fire still better be going when the building comes down. We now learn from the oral histories, moreover, that Giuliani is not the only one who was told the collapse was coming. At least four of the recently released oral histories indicate that shortly before the collapse of the South Tower, the Office of Emergency Management had predicted the collapse of at least one tower. The director of this office reported directly to Giuliani. So although Giuliani said that he and others were told that the towers were going to collapse, it was his own people who were doing the telling. As New York Times reporter Jim Dwyer has pointed out, the 9/11 Commission had access to these oral histories. It should have discussed all of these facts, but it did not. Another matter not discussed by the Commission was the collapse of Building 7. And yet the official story about it is, if anything, even more problematic than the official story about the towers. But before I go into this discussion, the organizers of this event are going to play some videos which will show both the towers and Building 7. And then I'll come back and finish the talk about this, about Building 7.
The building was designed to have a fully loaded 707 crash into it. That was the largest plane at the time. I believe that the building probably could sustain multiple impacts of jetliners because this structure is like the mosquito netting on your screen door, this intense grid, and the jet plane is just a pencil puncturing that screen netting. It really does nothing to the screen netting.
As if someone had deliberately set blasts to take place to cause the building to fall vertically downward.
A light-colored dust detonation zone quickly progresses down the side of the tower while the corner structure remains intact. Within 3 seconds, the detonation zone has become roughly 30 stories tall, with the dark smoke collapse zone far above.
We made it at least two blocks, and we started running. Floor by floor, it started popping out.
It was like it was if it had detonated.
Yeah,
if they were planned to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
All the way down. I was watching it and running.
We will bring you more as soon as we have it. Eileen LaPalmer, 1010 Winds, live outside of City Hall.
Okay, now we have word from Washington that the Capitol and the Treasury are being evacuated. This in addition to the White House and to the Pentagon. The Pentagon apparently having been hit by a plane this morning, not unlike the World Trade Center Twin Towers, both of which appear to have been on the news of what had transpired here in New York City this morning. If you are a New York City firefighter, you are requested to report, ordered to report to your station immediately. We need the help this morning with a major disaster unfolding in New York City, and the world has changed markedly in little less than an hour. When we first got word that a plane had crashed into the World Trade Center, we then saw a second plane crash into the second tower of the World Trade Center. We later got word of a plane apparently crashing into the Pentagon, word that the White House had been evacuated, now the Capitol and the Treasury also having been evacuated. What we have not heard yet are casualty figures for what is obviously a massive disaster at the World Trade Center, and there is no doubt massive loss of life there.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Again, there has been a second explosion here in Manhattan at the Trade Center. We are getting reports that a part of the tower, the second tower, the one a bit further to the south of us, has collapsed. We are checking on that.
Well, it does appear that the second tower of the World Trade Center has collapsed. 1010 Winds account executive John Fleischer was looking at the building, and it was just 3 minutes ago. John, what did you see?
Oh, lots of smoke, and then the next thing I heard, an explosion, and the building from the top, the south building, just crumbled. Just completely went down. I saw it. It's hard to see all the pieces, but you can see it tipping over and just crashing.
Before, when I reported about an hour ago, there were people at their gas pumps who turned to look at the smoke that was coming from the city. Folks stepping out of bodegas and stores to look. Now people are gathering in large groups. In fact, in one corner, I saw a group of people actually holding hands and praying. As I say, on the Manhattan Bridge, which is closed, it is open to pedestrian traffic. Some people are walking in crowds, but there's just no way for them to. I'm going to go out and take a look. It is, I can't even describe it.
Let's take a closer look at the dust cloud rising up from the base of the North Tower before it started to fall. It appears to be associated with the massive explosion that occurred 17 seconds before the tower starts to fall.
Now people are gathering in large groups. In fact, in one corner, I saw a group of people actually holding hands and praying. As I stand on the Manhattan Bridge, which is closed, it is open to pedestrian traffic. Some people are walking past, but there's just no way for them to. As I look out, something is that I can't.
The dust clouds following the ejected debris are consistent with an explosive event, whereas large chunks of concrete would normally result from a simple collapse. This would indicate that a powerful explosion, similar to a cannon firing a cannonball, must have ejected this heavy steel debris with equal upward and outward force to create this shape of projectile motion.
From the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
Around the area, New Jersey Transit outbound Hoboken terminal operating on a load-and-go basis, no inbound service, and also out of Newark Penn Station, limited service on the Northeast Corridor and North Jersey coastlines and the Raritan line as well, and limited service from Penn Station and New York into Penn Station and Newark, and no service into the city on New Jersey Transit. Also, New Jersey Transit operating on a...
Now let's use forward and reverse to analyze the shock wave that ripped through the building.
You know, we heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. Turned around, we were shocked to see that the building was, it looked like there was a shock wave ripping through the building and the windows all busted out, and, you know, it was horrifying. And then, about a second later, the bottom floor caved out. And the building followed after that, and we saw the building crash down all the way to the ground. We were in shock.
Difficulties around the area. New Jersey Transit outbound Hoboken terminal operating on a load-and-go basis, no inbound service, and also out of Newark Penn Station, limited service on the Northeast Corridor and North Jersey coastlines and the Raritan line as well, and limited service from Penn Station and New York into Penn Station and Newark, and no service into the city on New Jersey Transit. Also, New Jersey Transit operating on a load-and-go basis out of New York Penn Station.
Well, I didn't realize because the other towers are so big, but number 7 is 47th story.
That's explosive energy creates hot dust clouds rising like a volcanic eruption.
By the other two, it was kind of a reddish brown, and it more or less ran east and west. It was a long, thin building, but it had been damaged, and it had been on fire for hours, and the smoke just seemed to intensify. But we really couldn't see a lot of damage from this angle, from the north side of the structures. That's why everybody was so surprised when all of a sudden it just fell.
We observed that World Trade Center 7 fell faster than the speed of gravity, equivalent to the speed of free fall in a vacuum. We must conclude that a vacuum was created characteristic of an implosion where the structure is pulled down by a controlled demolition. Our supporting evidence is that debris fell neatly within the footprint of the building. An eyewitness heard a loud clap of thunder and saw a shockwave rip through the building, blowing out windows, before the ground floor exploded, and a second later, the building came down.
That's the thing is that when number two went down, I don't think, and I know.
The U.S. Geological Survey website provides us with a definition of a pyroclastic flow as a ground-hugging avalanche of hot gas and debris.
Huge buildings that have been here so long would actually just fall, and that's what happened. They just crumbled.
The rising gas chimney is clearly visible in this photo of the North Tower implosion with pyroclastic flows between buildings. The cauliflower shape of the debris clouds is a telltale sign of pyroclastic flows generated by massive explosions typical of volcanic eruptions and controlled demolitions.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Ben. That is the second building that has gone down. It came out like a plume of smoke, like a banana unpeeling, plumes of smoke coming out.
As I was saying, Building 7 is even a bigger problem for the official theory, partly because it was even more difficult to explain how in the world it could have collapsed, because it was not struck by an airliner. So none of the theories about how the airline impact contributed to the collapse of the tower could be used in relation to Building 7. Also, all the photographic evidence suggests that the fires in this building were small, not very hot, and limited to a very few floors. Photographs on the north side of the building show fires only on the 7th and 12th floors of this 47-story building. So if the south side, which faced the towers, had fires on many floors, as the defenders of the official theory say, the fires were not big enough to be seen from the back of the building. In other words, they didn't spread throughout the floors. And of course, it would not be surprising if the fires in this building were even smaller than those in the towers, because there was no explosion or jet fuel to get the fire started. Some defenders of the official theory, of course, claim that the diesel fuel that was in this building got set on fire and caused Building 7 to become a towering inferno. But if that's the case, why did none of all the photographers and videographers who were there that afternoon, why did not one of them capture that amazing sight on film? The extreme difficulty of explaining the collapse of Building 7, assuming, of course, you're not allowed to mention explosives, has been recognized by the official bodies. The report prepared under FEMA supervision came up with a scenario involving the diesel fuel, but then they admitted that this scenario had only a low probability of occurrence. And even that statement is generous, because the possibility that some version of the official theory about 9/11 is true is the same as it is for the towers, essentially zero, because it would violate many laws of physics. In any case, the 9/11 Commission, perhaps because of this admission by FEMA, handled the problem of the collapse of Building 7 by simply not mentioning it. This was, incidentally, one of the Commission's most amazing omissions. According to the official theory, Building 7 had demonstrated for the first time in history that the old theory was wrong, that fire could bring down steel frame high-rise buildings. So building codes around the world would have had to be changed. Insurance rates around the world should have been changed. And yet, the 9/11 Commission, in its 571-page report, could not find a single sentence to devote to this most amazing occurrence. Yet another reason why the collapse of Building 7 is especially problematic is that it was even more similar to the best-known type of controlled demolition than was the collapse of the towers. This is an implosion that begins at the bottom. As Eric Huffsmit has written, Building 7 collapsed at its bottom. The interior fell first. The result was a very fine, a tiny pile of rubble, with the outside of the building collapsing on the top of the pile. The fact that the collapse of Building 7 looked just like an ordinary implosion was noticed even by non-professionals. Dan Rather, that very evening, showing a video of the collapse of Building 7, commented that it was reminiscent of those pictures that we've all seen too much on television when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down. I don't think Dan ever repeated that comment again. And I don't think Building 7 has ever been shown, the collapse of Building 7, on mainstream TV again. It's just too revealing. A website about the demolition industry called Implosion World, which you can find by going on Google, says that an implosion is by far the trickiest type of explosive project, and there are only a handful of blasting companies in the world that possess enough experience to perform these true building implosions. Can anyone really believe that fire would have just happened to produce the kind of collapse that can be reliably produced by only a few companies in the world? The building had 24 core columns and 57 perimeter columns. To hold the fire caused this building to collapse straight down would mean believing that the fire caused all 81 columns to collapse at exactly the same time. To believe the official story is to accept a miracle. Another reason why the collapse of Building 7 creates special problems involves foreknowledge of its collapse. We know of only a few people with advanced knowledge that the Twin Towers were going to collapse, and the information we have would be consistent with the supposition that they had learned this at the last minute. We can imagine, therefore, that someone saw some sign of the South Tower beginning to collapse and then sent out the word. But the foreknowledge of Building 7's collapse was more widespread and of much longer duration. This has been known for some time, at least by people who read firefighters' magazines. But now the oral histories have produced a fuller picture. At least 25 of the firefighters and medical workers reported that at some time that day, they learned that Building 7 was going to collapse. Firefighters who had been fighting fires in the building said that they were ordered to leave the building, after which a collapse zone was established. As medical worker DeCosta Wright put it, they measured out how far the building was going to come, so they knew exactly where we could stand, which was 5 blocks away. As to exactly when this expectation of a collapse began circulating, testimonies differ. But most of the evidence suggests that the expectation was communicated 4 to 5 hours in advance. But why would this expectation have arisen? The fires in the building were, according to all the photographic evidence, very small and few. So why would the decision makers in the department have decided to pull firefighters out of the building and simply stand around and wait for it to collapse? The chiefs gave a twofold explanation, damage plus fire. One chief said, when the North Tower fell, it ripped steel from out between the 3rd and 6th floors across the facade on Vesey Street. We were concerned that the fires on several floors and the missing steel could result in the building collapsing. Another chief spoke of damage and very heavy fire on many floors. But if there was very heavy fire on many floors and a 4-story hole in the facade, Why were these facts never captured on any film? Also, the official line about Building 7 is contradicted, we now know, by some of the testimonies in the 9/11 oral histories. For example, medical technician DeCosta Wright said, "I think the fourth floor was on fire. We were like, are you guys going to put that fire out?" Chief Thomas McCarthy said, "They were waiting for 7 World Trade to come down. They had fire on 3 separate floors, probably 10, 11, and 15, it looked like. Just burning merrily. It was pretty amazing, you know. It's the afternoon in lower Manhattan. A major high-rise is burning, and they say, we know." Moreover, even if the department's official story about the collapse of Building 7 were not contradicted by physical evidence and some of the oral histories, it would not explain why the building collapsed, because no fire, amount of fire and structural damage had ever done this before. And it certainly would not explain the particular nature of the collapse, that it imploded and collapsed straight down at virtually free fall speed, and had all the other standard features of controlled demolition, such as the production of an enormous dust cloud. The extreme difficulty that the collapse of Building 7 presents for the official theory is illustrated by the recent book, 102 Minutes, one of the authors of which is New York Times reporter Jim Dwyer, who wrote the stories in the Times about the release of the 9/11 oral histories. With regard to the Twin Towers, Dwyer and his co-author, Kevin Flynn, support the theory put out by NIST, according to which the towers collapsed because the airplanes knocked the fireproofing off the steel columns. But when Dwyer and Flynn come to Building 7, they do not ask why it collapsed, given the fact that it was not struck by a plane. They simply say, the fire department decided to allow the fire to burn itself out. But of course, that's not what happened. At about 5:30 that afternoon, the building simply suddenly collapsed in essentially the same way as the Twin Towers had. Should this fact not have caused Dwyer and Flynn to question NIST's theory that the towers collapsed because the plane knocked their fireproofing off? I would especially think that Dwyer, who reported on the release of the 9/11 oral histories, should now reassess NIST's theory in light of the abundant evidence of explosives in the towers provided by those testimonies. This is, in any case, the only theory that explains both the nature and the expectation of the collapse of Building 7, namely, that explosives had been set and someone who knew this spread the word to the fire chiefs. Amazingly enough, a version of this theory was publicly stated by an insider, Larry Silverstein, who owned Building 7. In a PBS documentary aired in September of 2002, Silverstein, discussing Building 7, said, "I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire, and I said, we've had such a terrible loss of life, maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and we watched the building collapse." It is very puzzling, to be sure, that Silverstein, who was ready to receive billions of dollars in insurance payments for the buildings on the assumption that they had been destroyed by alien terrorists, would have made such a statement, especially with the television camera running. But his assertion that Building 7 was brought down by explosives, whatever the motive behind it, explains how and why the building collapsed. But we still have the question of why the fire department came to expect the building to collapse. It would be interesting, of course, if that information came from the same agency, the Office of Emergency Management, that had earlier informed the department that one of the towers was going to collapse. And we have it on good authority that it did. Captain Michael Currid, the president of the Uniformed Fire Officers Association, said that sometime after the collapse of the Twin Towers, someone from the city's Office of Emergency Management told him that Building 7 was basically a lost cause and we should not lose anyone else trying to save it, after which the firefighters in the building were told to get out. However, that answer, assuming it to be correct, leaves us with more questions, beginning with, who in the Office of Emergency Management knew in advance that the towers and Building 7 were going to collapse? How did they know this? And so on. These questions could be answered only by a genuine investigation, one not run by the White House's man inside the 9/11 Commission. For those of you who don't know what I'm referring to, the 9/11 Commission was run by its executive director, Philip Zelikow. He had a staff of about 80 people. He decided what topics would be investigated and what topics not. He decided what would go in the final report and what not. Philip Zelikow was essentially a member of the Bush administration. He had been a member of the national security team in the first Bush administration. He and Condoleezza Rice worked closely together. Then when the Republicans were out of office, Clinton was in office, Zelikow and Rice wrote a book together. Then when Condoleezza Rice was appointed National Security Advisor, she brought him on to help with the transition. And now she has pulled him into the State Department. So the idea that the 9/11 Commission was an independent commission makes as much sense as it would if the commission had been directed by Richard Cheney. So we need a real investigation to find out most of the questions. But it's already possible to know beyond a reasonable doubt one very important thing. The destruction of the World Trade Center was an inside job, orchestrated by terrorists within our own government. Foreign terrorists. Foreign terrorists could not have gotten access to the buildings to plant the explosives. And they probably would not have had the courtesy to make sure that the buildings came straight down. And they could not have orchestrated a cover-up, from the quick disposal of the steel, to the FEMA report, to the 9/11 Commission report, to the NIST report. All of these things had to be orchestrated by forces within our own government. The evidence for this conclusion has thus far been largely ignored by the mainstream press, perhaps under the guise of obeying President Bush's advice not to tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories. But we have seen that it is the Bush administration's conspiracy theory that is the outrageous one, according to which 19 Arab Muslims outwitted the most sophisticated air defense system in history and then defeated many laws of physics. There is, of course, another reason why the mainstream press has not pointed out these contradictions. As a recent letter to the Los Angeles Times said, the number of contradictions in the official version of 9/11 is so overwhelming, it simply cannot be believed. Yet the official version cannot be abandoned, because the implication of rejecting it are far too disturbing, that we are subject to a government conspiracy of X-Files proportions and insidiousness. The implications are indeed disturbing. Many people who know or at least suspect the truth about 9/11 probably believe that revealing that truth would be so disturbing to the American psyche, the American form of government, and global stability that it is better to pretend to believe the official theory. But I would suggest that whatever merit that argument may have had at one time, or seemed to have had, that has been overcome by recent events and revelations. Far more devastating to the American psyche, the American form of government, and global stability will be the continued rule of those who brought us 9/11, because the values reflected in that horrendous event have been reflected in the Bush administration's lies to justify the attack on Iraq. Its disregard of environmental science. Its disregard for environmental science and the Bill of Rights. Its criminal negligence both before and after Katrina. And now its apparent plan not only to weaponize space, but also to authorize the first use of nuclear weapons. In light of this situation and the facts discussed in this lecture, as well as dozens of more problems in the official theory about 9/11, I call on the New York Times to take the lead in finally exposing to the American people and the world the truth about 9/11. Taking the lead on such a story will, of course, involve enormous risk. But if there is any news organization with the power, the prestige, and the credibility to break this story, it is the Times. It performed yeoman service in getting the 9/11 oral histories released. But now the welfare of our republic, and perhaps even the survival of our civilization, depend on getting the truth of 9/11 exposed. I am calling on the Times to rise to the occasion. But the Times and the press in general are more likely to act if there is a widespread movement demanding the truth about 9/11. So I call on citizens who are hearing these words to form or join this movement. Finally, as a Christian theologian, as a member of a religion that began as an anti-imperial religion, I call on my fellow Christians to have leaders rise up as we had in the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam movement. We now need religious leaders to provide direction and inspiration for the 9/11 truth movement. Thank you very much for your kind attention.